Sports, wine, life. This is the Macko and Cause podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Macko and Cause podcast. It is Monday, June 8th. I don't know why I'm giving a date. Makes it seem more official for some reason. It's episode 170. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Matthew, it makes it more official, but it'll also make it dated to the people who want to listen tomorrow.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe it's June 8th. Maybe it's not. We'll never know.
It's June 8 hyphen 11.
Yeah, exactly. It's like 8 and 11 got married and no one wanted to drop their last name.
That's a funny line.
That's always been like, I don't know, like that's always been like a hard thing, I think, today to try to convince the other person. You got to take my name. It's a bygone era kind of thing, but
it's a pointless exercise. My wife kept her name. I'm not even sure. Like, it's everybody's choice, but people thought that was interesting, and I have no idea why.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's just interesting because when you guys got married, that was. How long is when you guys got married? It was like 2005? When was it?
I don't know. I think it's been 16 years.
So four.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So how was your wedding anniversary this year? What did you guys do?
You know how we celebrate stuff, Matt.
Big, out on the town, dinner, dancing, drinks.
We are the opposite of you and Amy. Like, Amy puts aside a week for your birthday.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure we got married between, to your point, between 2003-2006.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems to make sense.
So we didn't really, I was busy all week last week. We didn't get a chance to talk. The biggest story in the world continues to be the biggest story in the world. How are you handling it on your show?
I'm talking about it every day, you know, the murder of George Floyd by the Minnesota police, and then, you know, leading to the demonstration, sometimes protests, sometimes rioting, its impact on sports, just its impact on life. Oh, no, it's been a major part of the show. Some people will text in. They're not happy about that. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, that's dims the brakes. But it's going to be part of the show. I'm leading off my show today with the NFL and everything that happened on Friday with the PSA from the players that I know we'll talk about. But yeah, like, we haven't been told by anyone don't talk about it or anything like that. It's more just, you know,
I'm sure it's the opposite. I'm sure.
Yeah.
Like, if you didn't talk about it as a group, it would look insane. I'm actually kind of amazed by certain media groups, how they're not leaning in as much as I thought that they would. Pretty disappointed in a lot of ways. But, well, let's talk about the NFL because there's so many things to discuss, but it's a good enough jump off point so that we can get into other thoughts as well.
So the NFL, and if people haven't seen it, there was a PSA, I believe it was released on Friday, and it was a whole bunch of players, starting with like Michael Thomas and Saquon Barkley and Patrick Mahomes, where they put out their own PSA saying, you know, time with basically telling the NFL, you didn't do enough. You've got to admit that you were wrong. You've got to admit Black Lives Matter. And it's a really powerful, it's a little over a minute long video where players are saying, I could have been George Floyd. And after that video, the NFL changed its messaging. And it's pretty remarkable where the original message by Roger Goodell is, we're saddened by recent events and we feel their pain and urgent action is needed. Then after the video, the new Roger Goodell message was, we, the NFL, admit we were wrong for not listening to NFL players earlier and encourage all to speak out peacefully. We, the NFL, believe Black Lives Matter. That is a hell of a switch for Goodell and the NFL. And I'm not applauding them, but the messaging has changed because of this PSA.
Well, I'll applaud them only in the sense that they put out the message they should have put out first, or at least something closer to it. So even if they had to be shamed into it, and also kind of in a business sense, I'm sure Roger Goodell and the owners looked at this and thought, you know, when Patrick Mahomes is in that video, and he's your MVP and the future of the league, and he's saying, here's what I expect you as a league to say, and you don't say it, you're going to lose. You're going to lose. You're going to lose fan interest. You're going to lose fan support. You know, Goodell didn't do the one thing that he could have done that really would have shown they were serious. Mm-hmm. He didn't mention Colin Kaepernick, right?
He might not be able to because of legal reasons. I don't know. It would
consider that. But it's amazing to me how the NFL, the two biggest stories of our lifetime in some ways, at least post 9/11, have been COVID and these George Floyd protests and demonstrations. And in a weird sort of way, they have this odd anchor in the sports world. The COVID cascading shutdown started with the NBA.
Yep.
And in a lot of ways, one of the last totally sort of, I don't want to say totally peaceful, but the Colin Kaepernick, the way he was shut out of the league, how it was clear there was enormous amounts of the fan base that reacted so negatively to people taking a knee. And we almost forget it. That whole protesting in the NFL became about free speech, but it started as a Black Lives Matter against police brutality protest.
Yes. That's how it started.
You know, people found it a lot easier to support the idea of free speech. They didn't find it, a lot of these same people, easy to support the free speech stating that police brutality has to end. And the fact that, like, I just think that it's so crystal clear that when people say, well, we got to defend the right to protest, there were protests and you didn't defend them. Like, you're the same people who said you have to stop that or we're going to fine you or we're going to castigate you. Like, whenever you're bringing on change, I guess you have to accept the fact there's going to be people who push back. But these same people now who talk about, you know, how important it is to peaceably protest and what they're seeing is not acceptable are the same ones who tried to shut down the peaceful protests.
I mean, this is quite a switch now from 2017 to today. And, you know, what needs to happen, and this you see it the most, the NBA, but the owners and the commissioner, they have to treat the other side as a partnership, not as an adversary. We certainly see that going on in baseball and in football. You know, it's like this. When Kaepernick took a knee, the owners, it was well within their right to tell the employees, we don't want you kneeling. When you're at the football field, that is a place of work. I'm the boss. Technically, you can make that argument. However, when what they're kneeling for was of something of such importance, maybe you go, okay, I'm going to upset a couple of our fans, but this is what our partners feel really strongly about. Let's listen to them and let's find a way that, you know, that both sides are happy, and more importantly, that we make sure that the players are satisfied. They didn't do that.
Sports are inherently conservative. I think that progressive individuals within it, but as a, you know, we'll call it as a world or a culture, it's an inherently conservative entity. And I think we saw that, you know, really loud and clear with the Washington Redskins name change when it was suggested that they should change the name because there was a community that found it upsetting. I think the primary argument against it was heritage, that it's always existed this way and why should we give up what we had, right?
Yeah.
Or have always had. And that's, you know, I don't want to start equating conservatism with racism. However, one of the primary arguments against some of the changes that are being suggested is that we haven't done it this way before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think people really just got to get over that. And it's interesting to watch the sports world struggle with this because even, you know, on a daily level, all the way to the 30,000 foot level, so much of what has kept sport vital in culture and certainly as a culture, a self-contained one, is this idea of we've always done it this way. You know, this is who we are. You kind of see it with the cops too, right? Like this idea of this is who we are and we're a distinct thing and we, you know, people can't tell us how to be. You know?
Yeah.
That idea of the thin blue line and the idea that you have, you know, the Buffalo policemen who are applauding outside the courthouse when the two cops who had been suspended left, you know, I mean, that it's an insane display of solidarity, but there's a weird sense, sorry if I'm just rambling, but I just kind of want to say like sport is pointless right now in a lot of ways. Like it's a fun confection and ultimately who cares? You know, but that said, it's an interesting environment in which to test some of these ideas, because you saw the players who were going to say, we're not going to be treated this way, and we're certainly not going to support the treatment of people this way. And you got the league that just doesn't want to rock the boat, doesn't want to rock sponsors, doesn't want to rock money, doesn't want an enormous fan base that want to keep it this way. You know, it's a culture clash in this world that's being played out at large.
You see, though, the interesting thing is that maybe part of the thing that the NFL and Goodell, and if you want to be cynical, and Goodell, their actions have allowed you to be cynical, is that they could see that maybe the tides are turning and the money is going to, you're actually almost risking the money by being tone deaf, you know, by coming out with the most boring platitudes, that could actually impact you negatively. That's part that I'm interested in, is could we now see that in 2017, teams were worried about Kaepernick because they're worried about their bottom line. You know, I always viewed it first as ignorant and greedy. Maybe now, like, wait a minute, this whole social justice thing, people are actually, we're going to make more money if we're actually on the right side of history.
Well, it's cynical, but it might also be accurate.
Yeah.
I think that there were a lot of Hollywood producers who looked at casting women differently after Me Too, mm-hmm. because they realized there was a huge section of the population that was going to punish them if they didn't. That had that movement gone away more quickly and perhaps more quietly, then some of the changes that we've started to see wouldn't be happening. The idea of casting, you know, people of color in different kinds of, you know, what would have traditionally just been a white person. Like, you know, I've read a million scripts. Very few of them have a race assigned to a character, but there's kind of like always been this invisible, quiet assumption that unless a character was written for a black person, why would you get a black person to play it? Like, you couldn't just have a high school teacher who was black, or else you would have to write that person as the black teacher.
Yeah, with a baseball bat and a megaphone.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, in some ways, that's a kind of a quiet racism, in that you kind of don't let people just be normal people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been thinking a lot about entertainment, and, you know, most North American entertainment is designed for people to chillax, right?
Yeah.
One of the things about this time is, you know, like, as a white upper middle class dude, you know, I personally feel like it's kind of my responsibility to sit with things right now that are kind of uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean just philosophically, like, isn't it horrible that people are treated this way? But sort of, what's my involvement in that? You know what I mean? And to sit with uncomfortable ideas that, you know what, just because I'm not out there doing something bad doesn't mean that by being quiet, I'm kind of not supporting it. And I think that's maybe the one learning, maybe above all others, I don't know, that people got to take away from this, is like, in order to make change, we got to actually change. And we can't just simply support the idea of change, but there actually have to be things that are no longer done in the same way, and that there are repercussions because of that. And if we really believe it, we have to live with that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much, generally speaking, entertainment's a good vehicle for that kind of message, because mostly entertainment's been there to help people forget about these kinds of things. You know, certainly sports, like, you know, we have these moments where we acknowledge certain values, but I don't think anybody in that world, certainly from the ownership side, really wants anything to change. So I find it a weird place to have this conversation.
Well, the interesting thing about sports is they're the ones that can react the quickest. Like, you see, you know, goals being scored in Bundesliga, and then immediately players taking a knee, or even at a NASCAR event, they you know, all the drivers did something on their own. I mean, obviously it's different because most of them are Caucasian, but they put out, you know, a video kind of, you know, saying Black Lives Matter and saying, you know, we've got to do better and it's up to us. And so it is interesting because, you know, you do a movie and it takes months to write and put it out, but you are seeing this with the players. The question now is, what's going to happen, you know, with owners and the leagues themselves, and what sort of tangible, I mean, these gestures, even if they're hollow by, say, Goodell, these gestures are still a symbol and they still can lead to something positive. The question is, what does that tangible change look like?
There's anger out there that's real beyond the point of justification. Philosophically, existentially, for lack of a better word, less pretentious word. And I wonder to what extent the sports fan is going to want to know the band is angry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like we've seen historically that we're very comfortable as a society saying that there is a kind of a invisible, sometimes evasive ideal that we're all trying to live up to, right? How much do you want to be told in your living room that we're not? And more specifically to each individual person, particularly the middle class and upper white suburban communities, you're not living up to it. Like, how much is the league going to let that message really come through? Not the one that says we all believe in equality, but the one that says you're the problem.
I think, well, first, I'd be very uncomfortable. Last thing anyone wants to hear is someone call them a racist. When you go, wait a minute, I haven't done anything. I've always been a good person. And as you mentioned, is that enough? And I think people, when they're watching sports, you know, they want to know about what's going to happen on third down versus an introspective look into themselves. And I have no answer to that in terms of just, you know, how far the league will go and what the reaction will be. I'm curious for things like, what will teams do in terms of contracts with security companies, with you know, levels of the police, of things like that? Will they distance themselves until, you know, the police and, or union, police unions or stuff like that, if there is, you know, tangible change from methods where how you de-escalate, or, you know, do you use an arm bar and you ban chokeholds and all these little things that actually can make a difference? Like, I wonder, what's the league going to do with that? I'm just talking the NFL now. Because, you know, that was one of the reasons I think they were so hesitant to support Kaepernick, is they're worried just about all the, you know, the police community that was entwined within NFL, the daily lives of NFL teams.
It's a great point, Matthew. And I was thinking about Trump's tweet. I guess it was in the last 48 hours. It's hard to keep track sometimes. But after Goodell re-expressed the NFL's intention to, you know, reconsider its policies, he basically sent out a tweet saying, oh, don't tell me that you're actually going to walk back this. I mean, I'm distilling his words. He said,
yeah, but that's what it was. Yeah. Yeah.
He said a lot more MAGA, but you could kind of see like there was the beginning of another culture war there, which is, if you acquiesce to quote unquote these people, then I could see Trump trying to rally his MAGA group to see that as an insult to law and order and to a certain way of life that, you know, he drums up the base, you know,
but see, this to me,
terrifyingly effectively,
this would be, here's what I'd love to see. I'd love Goodell to call the bluff. Like, if Goodell wants harmony within his league, he says, Mr. President, basically fuck off. Like, I'll deal with my sport. You try to deal with doing your job and stop tweeting out about we're going to get violent with the protesters. Because here's the thing, is that Trump or Goodell, like, uh-oh, I don't want his base turning their back on me, but it's not going to happen. Like, Americans love football so much. As much as they might love Trump and red hats and the good old days, you know what they love more? They love the Dallas Cowboys. I firmly believe that. I mean, yes, there will be a percentage that will walk away. Absolutely. But there might be a new percentage that come back or have respect for the NFL. I financially, I don't think it would hurt them. And I think in the end, there'll be a lot of, you know, it's like people that say they hate Nickelback, but they still listen to Nickelback because they've sold all those albums. There's going to be the Trump supporters who say, yeah, that's it for football. But guess what? They're still going to be watching the Red Zone channel on the NFL Network.
What's the police role at a football game now? Like, what happens security. If they start getting booed? What happens?
They take it. They get booed.
And then there's people in the audience that don't like it when you're booing the police. It feels like I'm listening to you talk and I'm just imagining, okay, let's project forward to October or November or whenever you can have a half-empty stadium in front of a football game, if that happens. But I'm just imagining that. There will be people who boo the police.
Yes.
And there will be people who are angry the police are being booed. And now you've got a bunch of people drinking, watching a contact sport, with the greatest divide in our, you know, Western society, just kind of like, it feels like a recipe for disaster.
I wonder, I mean, first, if the NFL, what they do then is you align yourself with security or with police that outline their tangible changes that they are doing. Like, there are simple ones you can do. I was listening to this one interview, and like, one thing that two things you can do. One, police do not need this level of weaponry that they the army is selling them. You can get rid of that. Two, more physical training for the police, so there's no more knees on goddamn necks. There's other ways to restrain. If you start showing you are doing these things that'll tangibly save lives, then I think that would quell some of the booing at the police. Also, you know,
that's
a lot of
point. You know, so that's the first sorry to interrupt, but that's a really great point. That if people feel like there's actually a genuine effort to address the problem and fix the problem, then perhaps the response would be muted.
I think the response would be different.
So that's a, you know what, I hadn't even really considered it as obvious a point as it is, just because we're so angry right now. It's hard to imagine a time when that could happen, but that's a great point.
Those are simple solutions. You know, like the whole thing about defund the police, it's more like, okay, let's use the resources better. And maybe, you know, some of the resources being used on weaponry, if you use it for more to help communities and education, then you're going to have less crime down the road. So you don't need guys dressed up like they're the first edition of Iron Man when, you know, with Tony Stark.
Right. Yeah. The stuff he makes in the case.
Yeah.
Afghanistan. You know, I want to talk about this defund thing because I feel like this is one of those great red herrings that the conservative base can jump on and make it sound like what people are saying is don't fund the police.
Yeah.
When in actual fact, I want to take the conservative argument here if I can, because one thing conservative politicians are really good at is saying, okay, here's a public institution that is failing. How do we address that? Right.
Yeah.
So are we wasting money here? Like if it was healthcare or it was public education, it seems like we're pretty good at finding ways to cut and say, okay, but it's not working. So we have to reallocate resources, right? Mm-hmm. I've never heard a conservative politician, and maybe they exist, and if so, please correct me, someone, but a politician stand up and say, it's pretty clear that with public policing through the force as it exists right now, it's not working as well as it needs to, and in some cases to dangerously bad consequences. So let's look at it.
Yeah.
Like nobody will look at the cops. It's like this crazy third rail. Like we will look at healthcare. We will look at education. We will look at any number of public institutions. But the best of my knowledge, the number one budget line in the city of Toronto is cops. Like, And the argument that I've heard, the best one for defunding, is maybe we ask our cops to do too much.
Like, yes, I think we do. Like,
they should not
be in charge of mental health.
No, exactly. Like, you know, we ask them to enter situations. Like, maybe there needs to be fewer police doing fewer things. You know, maybe the actual best way to use a police force is not the way we're doing it. But there's a crazy systemic belief that we become so terrified of each other that the number one thing we're willing to pay for is a group of people who are willing to murder on our behalf to keep us safe.
Yep.
It's deranged thinking. And I actually think, like, okay, let's think like conservatives here. If there is a public institution that's failing, let's audit it.
Yes. I mean, that's what a lot of this is about, is transparency. And I, like, you know, neither one of us are qualified, you know, to dig into the books and say, here's what needs to be done. Like, my two suggestions were just like ones I heard from other police. And it's just like, that seems to make sense. But I think part of the emotional conversation is, you know, their job in general is more dangerous than almost any other job. So then we're like, who are we to tell them how the money should be spent on them? Like, I think that's part of where it comes from. And then other part politically is, you know, the police unions make up pretty large voting blocks.
Yeah. It's 100% true. And, you know, in the last 2 months, it hasn't been a great time period for unions, because we've watched the police union basically tell the public to go fuck itself. And the teachers union right now, To the best of my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but the teachers union, I've been told, has been dissuading teachers from doing too much online because you don't want to prove that it works. Mm-hmm. So the kids are kind of being held out to dry a little bit. Maybe I'm wrong about that. And if you're a teacher and you've heard otherwise, please let me know. But I've heard from a number of sources how much online teaching a teacher should actually do right now is a fairly contested issue behind the scenes. And there's a lot of teachers who feel like they'd be going against the union by trying too hard to make online learning work. And with COVID, who knows, with how many waves we might have, this might be, you know, it's funny, Matt, I keep coming back to this phrase, the new normal. Do you remember when COVID first struck and people were working from home and we talked about how, oh, what's the new normal going to look like? Are people going to work from home? Is there going to be distance learning? Is going to be this? I don't understand why we have such a hard time as a culture saying the new normal as applies to don't murder innocent people.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that new normal.
I'm fine with
whatever it takes to get there.
It's a hot take.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I don't want to be the, I've wanted to tweet things a million times, but I also don't want to be, I want to live the change more than I want to talk about it, even though I know that that's probably not the best approach, but there's so much virtue signaling that goes on. And I think the question becomes, Matt, when it comes to change, how much are you willing to really give back? You know, I had to talk to my daughter this week about not just how there's bad people out there, because she knows that we haven't hidden a lot of that from her from the time she was little. Yeah. You know, we've talked to her about racism and how cultures are built on slavery. And maybe people would disagree with us, but that's how we chose to raise our kid. But, you know, we had to make her know that we live in a nice house and we have a lot of freedoms. And the system is kind of built so it's easier for us to have that. So in order to fix it, do we have to give some of that back? And if we really believe it, like one of the things that I find is really, it's a really tough thing for people to acknowledge is that to actually make change, like it's not good enough just simply to say, hey, gang, everybody catch up. It's like we're going to have to give stuff back, whether it's, you know, colonial arguments with indigenous communities, you know, whether it's as simple as freaking tax dollars that businesses actually pay so that schools in bad areas, you know, get the money they need so that people who are going there can fairly compete with people who are going to good schools on the open job market in 15 years. You know what I mean? Like all these things we talk about how important they are. There's a lot of people who are going to have to give stuff back in order to make it real.
I think it all starts at the schools. I think it all starts at the school level of what you just said, of that example of making it so that it doesn't matter what neighborhood it's in. Every school has the same equipment and the same access. I think that's the best spot where it starts.
You know, and I guess what's so frustrating about this is we know that the police the Black community differently. And we know this not because, well, we know this for two reasons. One, people in the community tell us. And two, any reasonable audit of how things are done show this conclusively and scientifically. So it's not like there's any mystery that there's a bias out there. So what are we going to do? It's not good enough to say, I know it's wrong. What are you actually going to do? I guess this is why one of the reasons why I find it hard to, like, I should be really excited about the NBA coming back. I should be. But I just can't be right now. You know what I mean?
That's fair. Yeah.
I want to be. Mm-hmm. You know, I probably will be when it does come because, you know, life has to be a balance of struggle and joy, right?
So then, Bob, you haven't seen the Instagram of Marc Gasol because he looks ripped.
He looks good.
Kyle Lowry is in great shape.
You know, when I saw Gasol, I just thought, you know, like, it's like when Drax looked at Thor in the Avengers Infinity War. Mm-hmm. He looks like a pirate with an who's, you know, a pirate crossed with an angel.
Yeah, that was a great scene. Yeah, you see that, and then you just start thinking, I hope Joel Embiid is fat. I hope Joel Embiid is fat.
Yeah, that's so funny. And the fact that Kyle Lowry is pumped. Matt, you know, we talked a lot about just what sport is supposed to do and what it can do, and I don't know what the answers are.
And by the way, just one thing getting back earlier, I think one of the reasons why there's the conservative nature of sports is because, as you talked about back how it was in the old day, it's because you remember your memories as a kid watching sports, and it does become a tradition. And it's like, this is how I did it because I always enjoyed this. You know, some of my fondest memories, you know, like going to a ball game with my dad, or, you know, the first time I fell in love with the NFL or basketball, and just the traditions of, oh, I remember the family used to get together and giggle when the Leafs would beat Ottawa in the playoffs every year. And so it does become entwined within our collective pasts.
So I want to talk sports with you, but can I just make two blanket statements and then I'm going to try to shut up, because I'm not an expert and I feel like I've made a million mistakes in my life and I'm making them now and I'm just trying to figure out what to do as best possible. But I think what we're seeing now in our culture is, one, a group of people who are looking at the demographics of the world that they live in and seeing that they're changing and they don't know where they fit into it, and it's frightening. Which is a human reaction. And even though I think that it's not a justification for behavior, it's an explanation. And I think we can start there. And this goes even right to the Christian community where, you know, the numbers of young kids who are following the parents' path are starting to drop for the first time in a long time. Like, there's just a lot of changes and it's terrifying to people. They need to do better, but we're going to start with the explanation. The second thing is that democracy in the free market has been really good for creating an upwardly mobile merchant class. And there's a lot of people who gained a lot, you know, through globalization, through all that stuff. What I think the people who got rich realized is it's also problematic for hanging on to the cash that you made, because people want a fair shot at it too. And so I think there's the push from up top too, which is making it harder for people who are trying to take care of themselves to actually take care of themselves, because people don't want to give up what they've gotten, which brings me back to this whole thing of, what are you willing to reinvest into society to make it more fair? So I'm looking at this and everything I'm seeing, and I'm saying it's power that doesn't want to give it back. And it's a whole group of people that are watching the world change and saying, I don't know where I fit in this anymore. And I don't know that it's resolvable, you know, without a really dramatic rethink of what it means to be a neighbor.
I think Jeff Bezos just gives up all his money. And I think that, yeah, start there. Let Bezos solve it.
He's on the path to become the world's first trillionaire. And America's on path to have 20% unemployment.
Like, yeah.
It's like this deranged situation. And anybody who's not feeling crazy by it is probably not paying enough attention. But then there's also the fact that, like, nobody wants to go crazy. Who wants to live in terror? Like, it's a very complicated place to ask people to be, myself included. I oscillate wildly between the, you know, I'm furious, and the why do I have to hate my life feeling? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or life in general. Anyway, I'm sorry. Here I'm doing true confessions. Let's talk sports.
By the way, before we get to sports, I don't know if you know this, Bob, but there are now two listeners who have used Jeff Pollock.
I'm extremely happy to hear that.
Yes, he is our lawyer. If you need a lawyer, I mean, my God, right now, you know, all the uncertainty, it's never a bad thing. It's a small law firm. It's from a really decent guy with a really nice wife and a bunch of good kids. His name is Jeff Pollock. He's our title sponsor here. And he's helped us out, and he can help you in a very simple and just non-intimidating, non-threatening way. Because I get threatened by lawyers because they know stuff I don't know. And they use words I have no idea. And they use Latin. Who uses Latin? Well, actually, Bob, you do. But the number is 416-777-0088. 416-777-0088. Or you can contact him, jeffpollock.com. That's Jeff with a G, jeffpollock.com.
So I feel like I need to talk about something lighter right now.
Yeah.
Can we talk about what can we talk about, Matt?
Well, we are going. Ooh, I could do my hatred for Golden State. Nah, we don't. Oh, okay. How about this, Bob? You want to do a light, fun sports topic? I got one lined up for you. You ready?
Yes.
On this day in 1976, Bobby Orr signed a 5-year contract with the Chicago Blackhawks. So, famous players that looked really weird in different uniforms. I'm not talking about famous players that went to that last team and stunk. Forget about that. Just, like, imagine this guy in this uniform. Like, let me throw one out to you.
Okay, so
Did you realize that Ken Yeah. Sorry. Go.
No. Go ahead. I didn't realize you had a list. I thought you were asking my opinion. I still think the ultimate example of this would be St. Louis Blues great Wayne Gretzky.
It could, except absolutely, 100%. But at least he did some good things there. But you're right. No, this is just about what looks weird. So yeah, that's a perfect one. How about this? Ken Griffey Jr., 41 games as a member of the Chicago White Sox.
I don't even remember that.
Neither did I till I looked it up last night.
Wow. That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good game too. Like famous athletes that are so synonymous with one team. And then they, you know, like people don't talk a lot about Doug Gilmore being a Hab for an hour.
Especially these parts in Toronto. Like, we know the obvious ones, like Michael Jordan is a Wizard and Montana is a Kansas City Chief. But what about Jerry Rice at Seattle?
Wait, Wendell Clark? New York Islanders, Wendell Clark?
Oh, I see. I totally forgot about that. See, that's a perfect one.
Now I'm really thinking about this. I'm trying to think about baseball, too, not just hockey.
Pete Rose, Montreal Expos, year in 1984.
That's a great example. You really have to become synonymous with the team and then just sort of, and then I guess really the key to it is your time with that new weird team is so inconsequential. You didn't like Roger Clemens felt weird when he wasn't in a Red Sox uniform, but he had so much success with other teams.
Yeah.
So it was weird to see him as a Yankee. I'm sure if he were a Boston fan, you know, I mean, he won two Cy Youngs outside of the Sox.
Yeah.
So yeah, it has to be sort of like a totally bogus time with it.
Let me give you two and you tell me which one is weirder.
Okay.
Hakeem Olajuwon starting 37 games for the Raptors, averaging 7 points per game, spent 17 years in Houston, or Tony Parker, 17 years with San Antonio, then 1 year with Charlotte.
Okay, Tony Parker is weirder. But they're both pretty good examples of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
This is a good topic. You're gonna have fun with this one.
Oh yeah. No, I got plenty for today's show. Today's show is actually packed.
Yeah. Cool. I feel like I'm done, Matt.
That's fine.
I feel like I'm done.
We can save my NHL reinvention players for another time.
Well, let's do it at the end of the week. Maybe on Friday. We'll get back to doing two.
Yeah. I get it. This is, you know, especially, having a kid and trying to figure out the best balance and everything. Yeah. I mean, this has, you know, I imagine all of this has been weighing and just weighing on your mind. And none of this is for anyone to feel sorry for you, but just the reality of just there's probably been a lot that, I mean, it's going through all of us, but I imagine being a dad, it's probably even amplified a little bit.
You know, Maddie, businesses and bosses are really fond of saying things like, you know, we acknowledge in these difficult times that you must be ...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But these are actually difficult times. Like, I've talked to a lot of people who are like, you know, I woke up and I cried. And I think it's been building for a long time in a lot of different ways. You know, it's good that we see what's happening. It's incredibly painful that we see what's happening. You know, I mean, think about how social media and just the experience, like that guy in Buffalo, the 75-year-old man who got shut down, you know, like we never would have known if we hadn't seen it. Yeah. But like, I've seen that video, like now I've seen video of an old man being pushed to the ground and having his head split open like 50, 60 times. Like it's freaking awful, you know?
Yeah.
It's better to know, but these actually are difficult times. You know, good news is hopefully COVID starts to lift and we can start getting outside more and seeing each other more. And, you know, if there was ever a time that we needed to see each other and not just in the context of anger, but in the context of joy, you know, this must be it.
Yep. You want to end it there, Bob?
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to chicka because, you know, that's just what we do. I hope I wasn't too maudlin, Matt.
No, but hold on. This is one where it's supposed to be.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't hope I was too much. I mean, in a lot of ways,
you weren't.
I just want to say it the way I think it, but.
Yeah, that's what the purpose of this podcast is for.
You know, to everybody listening, you know, we're going to do our best, whatever that means.
Yeah. Bye, Bob.
Thanks for listening to the Macko and Cause podcast. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or Audioboom. And if you like the podcast, leave a review. If you don't like the podcast, then maybe don't leave a review.